for attorney's fees, but yet it seems to say quite frequently, you know, costs to respondent or costs to appellant, something like that. What they mean by that is simply the court costs, which are things like filing fees or transcripts or copies of the clerk's papers. They tend to be rather modest. Sometimes there's a jury fee or some other court cost. So you may have a case that involves, damages of $300,000, and the court costs amount to $750. So yes, the costs on appeal are awarded to the prevailing party, but it's not the big costs of the attorney's fees. It's just the stuff that they pay by way of, you know, the $200 fee to file the appeal or that sort of thing. Other preliminary questions? Okay. Well, as I said yesterday, we're done with the plaintiff's opening act, I suppose, in these three scenes of breach of duty, causation, and damages. The next part, immunity, contributory fault, joint tort feasors, and statutes of limitation, are essentially sort of the defendant's issues. Oftentimes, these need to be raised by the defendant, so-called affirmative defenses, where unless the defendant brings this out, pleads them, you'll learn about this in civil procedure, that they won't show up in the case. Whereas it's the plaintiff's burden to establish a breach of duty, it's the plaintiff's burden to establish causation, the plaintiff's burden to establish damages. It's not as though we haven't seen the defendant before. After all, the defendant would take positions, raise issues with respect to negligence or the standard of care or industry custom or the unforeseeability of the plaintiff's injury, that sort of thing. But again, the defendant up till now has sort of been asserting things by way of preventing the plaintiff from proving their case. Now we're looking at issues where the defendant is sort of has gone on the offensive, so to speak. And the first of these areas, Chapter 4, deals with immunity. And again, just sort of by way of overview, sometimes it feels in the immunity chapter as though we're revisiting the questions in Chapter 1. That is, do we say that the defendant has a duty to this plaintiff, or do we say that the defendant doesn't have a duty to this plaintiff? Do we want to impose liability on the defendant, or don't we? But the reason these cases are in Chapter 4 is because they would ordinarily, you would think, for example, that somebody who's struck by a motor vehicle in a crosswalk would be able to prove, well, this defendant didn't use reasonable care and therefore is subject to liability. But it turns out there are certain kinds of defendants, like governmental defendants, where their lack of reasonable care may not lead to liability because, for various policy reasons, we've decided these people are immune. And we'll trace the history of this whole doctrine of sovereign immunity, and as well as other kinds of immunities. One of the things that I want to emphasize, because it's often misunderstood, we start with the Federal Tort Claims Act, and we start with the federal, with a case interpreting the Federal Tort Claims Act, and we're all used to the idea of the supremacy clause, that if the federal courts decide something is, for example, protected by the First Amendment, that's binding on the states. Or if the federal courts decide that a criminal defendant has to be warned about his so-called Miranda rights before you interrogate him, again, it's not as though the state can say, well, that's fine for you, but we've decided to do things a different way. So again, we're sort of used to this idea that once the federal courts decide something, everybody has to follow it. But in this area, we have the classic kind of federalism in which each state is viewed as a sovereign of its own. So the federal Congress, the United States Congress, may decide in the Federal Tort Claims Act it wants to waive sovereign immunity or it wants to waive it in this particular way, but that doesn't mean a state couldn't choose a very different kind of system, a broader or narrower scope of immunity. And again, one of the things that's characteristic of the issues in sovereign immunity is that, like wrongful death, they are controlled by statute. If you want to know the rules about sovereign immunity, rather than saying, well, some jurisdictions do this and some jurisdictions do that, most do this, only a few do that, what you want to know is how has this particular jurisdiction chosen to handle the question about the scope of sovereign immunity, or to look at it the other way, to what extent has the state agreed to waive its sovereign immunity. So on the exam, you will get a statute as you, well, maybe this brings back painful memories. As you got a statute on the last exam, there will be a statute regarding sovereign immunity, and in a similar fashion, you have to figure out from reading the statute, well, you know, what have they chosen to do here in the state of Linden or whatever is the hypothetical state that you've been plopped down into. Okay, so let's start with, look at the Federal Tort Claims Act by itself, but rather we'll come back to the Federal Tort Claims Act as we review Laird versus Nelms, because it raises these issues about interpreting it. So can somebody tell me about Laird versus Nelms? Mr. Rubio. Okay, and just sort of the technical part of it, it's Laird versus Nelms. This is back in the days when they swapped the names of the parties depending upon who was the appellant and who was the respondent. It turns out Nelms was the original plaintiff and Laird was the defendant. Why is this against Laird rather than the United States? Yeah, Melvin Laird was the Secretary of Defense. And you often see these suits against a person rather, but the real defendant, the so-called real party in interest, is the governmental agency or, you know, the U.S. government. Okay, so Nelms wants to recover for this damage caused by the overflight of these military aircraft. And on what basis does he say he's entitled to recovery?
He looks at the statute, the FTCA, and he looks at the verbiage in section 2674 that basically says that a private individual can bring suit under like circumstances but should not be liable for any.
Okay, and before we get down into the specifics of that, let's sort of draw the lens back to a more wide-angle view and sort of trace the history. How did we come up with the idea that individuals can sue the government and kind of give us a little bit of history here? Okay. What was derived from England? Okay. The principle of sovereign immunity was sort of inherited or developed early on in the common law. When somebody first attempted to get compensation from the government, the crown, or some other governmental entity for damage that they had caused to the plaintiff, the original response to that was, well, you can't do that. Royal court or a governmental court can't, in effect, be asked to be a judge of its own negligence or its own fault. The sovereign is immune. And so this principle that the sovereign is immune as a kind of starting principle is in some ways similar to the idea that we had in wrongful death cases that, well, in the absence of a statute, you can't recover for wrongful death. So this principle of sovereign immunity is kind of our starting point, but obviously the plaintiff thinks that things have changed. And what changed the landscape from that original position? Yeah, the Federal Tort Claims Act passed in 1946. It turns out that before the Federal Tort Claims Act, there had been compensation, but it had to be, you had to get an act of Congress to, quite literally, to get compensation. And in particular cases, if your congressman or congresswoman was willing to support your claim and ask that Congress appropriate money to compensate you because somebody negligently destroyed your property or caused injury or what have you, you could pass a bill through Congress to do that, but that's a pretty awkward way to go about getting compensation. So in 1946, Congress passes the Federal Tort Claims Act, which says, in summary, what's the gist of the Federal Tort Claims Act? Okay, it's not a simple demolition of the principle of sovereign immunity. It's a waiver of sovereign immunity in certain kinds of cases, with certain exceptions to that waiver. So we have to figure out what has been given up by way of waiver, what has been retained by way of waiver, and where does this case fit in that mix? Now, as you said earlier, the plaintiff's pointing to a particular part of the statute that seems to support their claim. And what's that? Tell me that again. What provision of the statute is that? So in analyzing whether the military would be liable for the property damage caused by these sonic booms, the plaintiff says, Congress says, we want you to evaluate that in the same fashion as though a private citizen were flying military jets over your land. That's an interesting concept. What would you be able to do if it were a private citizen, not necessarily a military jet? Hopefully private citizens don't have military aircraft, but they might have aircraft, and if they flew, you know, the Concorde or some other private entity was flying over your land and caused a sonic boom, what would you be able to plead by way of a legal theory? What legal theory could you bring in a case of an overflight, Mr. Ortiz? Nuisance, you could do a nuisance case. You could also do something they call trespass, sort of a related theory. Trespass is more of a physical invasion. Nuisance is more of a sort of aesthetic invasion. But one of these sort of strict liability theories in which you say a person with property rights, like the plaintiff, can recover when the defendant invades those property rights and causes damage. So it's this one that the plaintiff says we ought to use as our guide. And it turns out the Federal Tort Claims Act borrows from, in fact, you may have noticed this in the Harbison case, where a tort is allegedly committed by a federal employee or agency, you look to the law of the state where that tort took place. So when it was a federal employee and Air Force doctor who negligently advises Mrs. Harbison about the risks of getting pregnant while she's taking Dilantin. We ask the federal government uses the law, the federal courts use the law of the state of Washington. In this case, the damage took place in North Carolina, so the plaintiff says Congress has authorized the federal courts to use the law of the state of North Carolina, and if under North Carolina law there would be a claim for strict liability, then I get to plead that and pursue that against the federal government. So Congress has specified. But there's obviously another argument, the defendant's argument. Okay, so under 1346, we look for a negligent or wrongful act as the basis of liability. And the defendant argues that contrary to the claim of the plaintiff, the federal government's waiver of liability only extends to negligent or wrongful acts and does not include claims for strict liability. So the task of the day for the Supreme Court in a case like this is not so much to figure out, well, what would be good public policy? How should tort law in this area best balance the needs of society? Rather, the question is, what did Congress want? If Congress wants A, we give them A. If Congress wanted B, we give them B. So how do we figure out what Congress wanted here? Whether they wanted a broader kind of liability that would extend to the same kinds of claims that would be recognized under state law, or more narrowly to say, well, yeah, but only those kinds of claims that are based on a negligent or wrongful act. How do we determine which of these two interpretations more accurately reflects Congress's intent? Okay, that's another provision which may get involved here. I think that actually comes up sort of in the dissenting opinion about that. Ms. Shoemaker? Okay, and again, this fits into our long-term discussion about the way judges deal with sort of conflicting views of what the law should be. The first thing that a court will do in trying to interpret Congress's intent is to look at previous cases on the subject. That is, if there's already a decision of a court interpreting the statute, then that represents a kind of, you know, precedent, not a kind of, it represents precedent, and ordinarily under the principle of stare decisis, a court will continue the rule of law reflected in that precedent. But, of course, this is the United States Supreme Court, and to the extent that it goes back and finds a precedent that's either unpersuasive or doesn't really cover this issue or, you know, in some other way, the decision isn't helpful, if the court is convinced that there's other evidence that Congress really wanted something different, the U.S. Supreme Court could say, well, on second thought, despite this previous precedent, we think Congress really wanted this and now we're going to do it. But again, this whole process of figuring out if Congress wanted, you know, peanut butter on their toast, you know, it's not my favorite kind of breakfast, but hey, if that's what they want, that's what they get. Okay, so What precedent, if any, do we have in this case with respect to figuring out the scope of this waiver? Okay, what happened in the Dalhite case?
Well, the court ruled that it is to be, as he said, it is to be imposed only on negligent or wrongful omission of an employee.
And does this say anything about the facts of the Dalhite case? It's this Texas City disaster where a barge full of fertilizer-grade ammonia, actually one of the components, I think, in the Oklahoma City bombing case, you get a large quantity of this stuff, and it's explosive, and it ravaged this, I think it's Texas City, whatever it is, Louisiana or something. In any event, in that case, the plaintiffs tried to apply a strict liability theory, and the government said, or the Supreme Court said, no, can't do that. Now, as it turns out, Congress later compensated the people in the Dalhite case. They passed an act of Congress to compensate these people. So, well, you know, I don't know what that says about Congress's intent. Congress seemed to think these people needed to be compensated. But after the Supreme Court said it wasn't included in the Federal Tort Claims Act, they didn't change the Federal Tort Claims Act. So maybe Congress wanted to do this. So the Dalhite case, on the one hand, is a precedent, but we also have the court goes back and looks at the legislative history. We've talked about that a little bit before. What was said in Congress to recommend this bill? What objections were raised to the Federal Tort Claims Act? How were they answered by the sponsors of the legislation? What does it say in the committee reports that came from the committees that brought this to the floor of Congress, et cetera? There's all sorts of stuff there about what this means, what Congress had in mind. So, so here we are, and ultimately the Supreme Court has to pick which of these two it's more persuaded by, and where does the Supreme Court come out on that? Okay, and I think again we'll get to that in a moment, but just in terms of whether which of these two passages in the statute is sort of the controlling concept here. Yeah, the second one. The court says this is the part that we ought to pay closer attention to. Rather than the sort of expansive language the plaintiff has cited, that has to be sort of limited by or qualified by the language that said it's only a negligent or wrongful act. Strict liability without proof of a wrongful or negligent act doesn't cut it. Congress didn't want to be liable on that basis. Congress didn't want the federal government to be liable on that basis. Now, there is a dissenting opinion. There's a dissenting opinion that says we don't read the statute this way. And the dissenting opinion says, that Congress would have, or Congress permitted liability in case, liability in cases like this, but there's another argument that the government had that even if the statute waived liability for cases involving strict liability, the government has an additional argument as to why liability shouldn't be imposed in this case. And that's this idea about, tell me, where's the language about a discretionary function? Yeah. So again, as you look at the way that the Federal Tort Claims Act is laid out, it begins by saying you can sue us if you meet these criteria, but you may not sue us. We retain our immunity with respect to this set of cases. And it's sort of an odd list here of things for which immunity is retained. So, for example, in item B, this is on the very first page of chapter 4, item right-hand column under 2680, the second in the list, any claim arising out of the loss, miscarriage, or negligent transmission of letters or postal matter. So you can't sue the post office for negligently transmitting mail. This, of course, was before the post office was spun off as a sort of a private corporation or quasi-public. I don't know exactly what the post office's status is, but it used to be a part of the government like the EPA, and now it's in some other category. And item C here, collection of taxes. Again, you can't sue somebody for negligently imposing or failing to impose taxes or customs or that sort of thing. But the first one you cited, the very item A here, you can't sue for the performance or the failure to exercise or perform a discretionary function. What's that? What's a discretionary function?
It leaves it up to the court to decide what
qualifies. But what's the general concept behind a discretionary function as distinguished from what kinds of acts of government are not a discretionary function? Yeah. So the sort of antonym here, the opposite of a discretionary function, is a so-called operational function. Discretionary functions involve, as you said, policymaking, whereas an operational function would involve just an ordinary mistake. Somebody makes a left turn without judging the speed of the oncoming traffic, and so as they start to make this left turn, they realize they can't get through the intersection before this guy's going to hit them, and an accident ensues. That's an operational side of things for which the immunity has been waived. We get any sort of double and triple negatives here. It's kind of hard to remember what the polarity is of what you're talking about here. But again, the idea is that the government retains its immunity with respect to policymaking functions. If the president decides it's a good idea for us to invade Iraq, that's not something that you can say, well, that was a negligent, poorly conceived idea. Many people may believe that, but the remedy for policy-making mistakes is not through filing a tort suit, even though that allegedly negligent act may have cost you business or cost you personal injury or something else. The remedy for policy-making mistakes is essentially at the voting booth. Get different policymakers the positions of authority. Whereas for operational mistakes, the remedy is essentially, may include at least, a tort suit. So if you hit me in a crosswalk driving a government vehicle, I can sue the government for that. But if you negligently judge the rainfall, and you raise or lower the level of the lake, or you send large quantities of water rushing down the river because you think there's going to be a flood, even if I can prove that was mistaken based on faulty data and a reasonable person wouldn't have done that, if it falls within a discretionary policy-making area, it's immune. The government in this case would argue that What the plaintiff is complaining about is a policy. Said? So, what policy is that? What policy has the defendant undertaken that the plaintiff is complaining about? What exactly did the government do that the government says is essentially a policy decision, Ms. Keene? Yeah, that this was a smart way to train people to be military pilots, and in effect, what the plaintiff is saying to the government, this is the government's version, is that a reasonable policymaker would have chosen a different place for these pilots to practice their flying skills, or they would have flown at a slower speed. You can still learn how to fly a military jet without going three times the speed of sound. But if you disagree with that, or at least, to the extent, again, the government characterizing what's going on in this case, saying what you're really attacking is our policy making. And to the extent that you're doing that, it doesn't belong in court. If you don't like the way people are running the military, vote for a new commander-in-chief, is the argument. Or vote for a new Congress that'll direct how the military is to conduct its operations. Now, finding the line between these two, the concept that for this there is immunity, for this there is no immunity, it's often a judgment call about which people will have different ideas. There's a case later on in Chapter 11, I can't remember whether I previously mentioned it. It's called Brown versus United States. It involves three lobster fishermen who drown in the Atlantic Ocean because they took off from port with a weather report that said, brisk winds or something like that, but, it's going to be a little bit rough at sea today, but it turns out to be something closer to a perfect storm. And it sounds a lot, in fact, like, the movie or the book with that name. And their widows, the widows of these fishermen, sued the United States government saying, your negligence in it turns out there was a weather buoy that was out in the Georgia's Bank area that repeatedly got lost or failed to provide weather data and eventually just gave up on it. And so the plaintiff said, by failing to keep that adequately repaired and then acting as though you knew what the weather was going to be when you really didn't, you didn't use reasonable care. And the government said, no, wait a second. This is a policymaking judgment. Now, there are other issues that have come up in Chapter 11 which have to do with, essentially, am I my brother's keeper? Do I have an obligation to protect other people from harm, as opposed to, the Weather Service didn't negligently turn their boats over or something. So there's a whole issue in Chapter 11 of, do you have an obligation to do right in addition to having the obligation not to do wrong? So that's there's a whole Chapter 11 issue we'll get to, but there's a related issue in that particular case, which is, on which side of this line does the government's error fall? Does it fall on the side of being an operational mistake, or does it fall on the side of being a policy-making mistake? Because if it's on that line, the plaintiffs get to recover, but if it's on that line, the plaintiffs have nothing to complain about. They just get to vote for a new Congress. The trial judge in the case, Brown versus the United States, found that this was not a policy-making function, that where they